listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to another very special Film 11. This week, we're joined by Matthew of...
God rest ye merry gentlemen.
of KBOO's Gremlin Time. And also Lisa Neville of Cortland in New York State, where she shapes and controls insidiously the minds of the young.
In other words, she's a professor at the English department at the New York State University in Cortland, New York.
And part of that scheme is to join us today to discuss a movie called The Bishop's Wife, directed by Henry Koster and starring Cary Grant, David Niven, and Loretta Young, amongst other post-war luminaries.
We haven't forgotten that night down the centuries. We celebrated with stars on Christmas trees, with the sound of bells, and with gifts. But especially with gifts. You give me a book, I give you a tie. Aunt Martha has always wanted an orange squeezer. And Uncle Henry could do with a new pipe. But we forget nobody, adult or child. All the stockings are filled. All that is, except one.
Yeah, there's lots of great Christmas movies, you know, like Miracle on 34th Street and It's a Wonderful Life. But this particular movie seems to get at more of the heart of what the celebration is about.
Julia, you knew that Mrs. Hamilton and the others were expected here for the meeting this afternoon.
I know, Henry. I'm sorry I was late.
What a ghastly afternoon. What a ghastly woman. And I trust she understood that I have no intention of being strangled by her purse strings.
Oh, she did, and I was proud of you.
I had a most unchristian impulse to take those blueprints and give her a good whack over the mink coat.
I thought you stood up to her magnificently.
I appreciate your appreciation, but what about my cathedral?
May I make a suggestion, Henry? Why not postpone the cathedral? At least forget about it until after Christmas.
Impossible. House of God can't just be put off. This cathedral must rise. Plenty of other rich people in this town, and if I had to enlist their financial enthusiasm, then I shall have to take advantage of their Yuletide spirit.
Oh, I can see it all now. The McWithers, the Horns, the Van Dusens, the luncheons, the committee meetings, and you there flattering them, kowtowing to them, begging them.
It's got to be done.
Oh, Henry, if you could see your poor, harassed face.
Well, you haven't done very much to help it.
Wait.
So what are we learning from this that makes this movie so different from other Christmas tales, ranging from the famous stories by Dickens and especially contemporaneous Christmas stories that range anywhere from Miracle to Meet Me in St. Louis, which actually methodically goes through all of the holidays, culminating with Christmas, and which fascinatingly shows the tensions within a family that afflict people during the holidays. How does The Bishop's Wife fit into this view of Christmas?
You're absolutely right. Meet Me in St. Louis, Miracle on 34th Street, and It's a Wonderful Life. Those type of movies, which are really fine films, and actually are fairly complex versions of family life and people's psychic lives as they work through the Christmas season. Those are comedies. Those are dramas. Those are movies about families, about relationships, about people. This movie does have that. It is a movie about people's relationships with each other, but it's also a movie about people's inner lives, about people's relationships to themselves and their own integrity and these human values that make life beautiful and important, as opposed to those kinds of pleasures and material values that make life interesting or fun. And there's a real distinction. And I think in that way, this is the film that is most like Dickens, A Christmas Carol.
Henry, what's happened to you? What's happened to us and our marriage? We used to have such fun, you and Debbie and I. We used to be happy. We used to make other people happy. Oh, Henry, that was your gift. You're no financier and you're not a promoter.
Julia, you can't see beyond the end of your nose. I want this cathedral to stand like a great beacon. I want its light to shine.
Oh, never mind, Henry, never mind. Keep that for your next committee meeting.
Dickens' Christmas Carol is a scathing critique of materialist values. Scrooge has he's made himself unhappy and everyone around him unhappy because in his ruthless pursuit of money and property. And he comes to see that that is a hollow and empty value, and he comes to recognize the value of openness, generosity, and loving kindness. And that really, there's really no other movie that's as radical in that message as A Bishop's Wife.
Now, in the 1940s, a lot of fantasy movies came out, especially ones with supernatural beings coming to Earth. You had, like, I Married a Witch, and there was one about a mermaid. There's also the many ghost stories, the Canterville Ghost, the Ghost of Mrs. Muir, Topper Takes a Vacation, all sorts of nice comedies with a supernatural kind of twist to them, or some that are a little more serious, like A Guy Named Joe or Here Comes Mr. Jordan. So The Bishop's Wife, we have this angel played by Cary Grant who comes into this domestic problem to start sorting things out. And so he first appears to the bishop, Henry, in his office.
Good evening.
Good evening. What can I do for you?
That isn't the question.
Well, what is it?
What can I do for you?
Look, I'm afraid I must ask you to telephone my secretary for an appointment. I'm in the middle of dinner.
I know, Henry. Your soup will keep warm. You asked for help.
I? Who told you I asked for help?
Well, you are known to be a good man, Henry, and you were heard. I was instructed to come here in answer to your prayer.
Who are you?
I'm an angel.
I beg your pardon?
I'm an angel. No wings at the moment, but...
You're an angel. Oh, I knew it. I've been working too hard.
I understand, Henry. It's hard to believe, even for you. Of course, I'm not one of the more important angels. I just happen to be assigned to this district temporarily. You see, we're everywhere, helping people who deserve to be helped. As you're walking through the streets of the city, you may suddenly look into a strange face. It may be the face of a murderer, or it may be the face of an angel.
And so he inserts himself into the bishop's family and starts helping him.
And if I may interrupt, only David Niven as the bishop knows he is an angel.
Henry, is anything wrong? I'm sorry. I didn't know that you...
Julia, if you don't mind.
How do you do, Julia? I'm Dudley. Henry is engaging me to help him with his work.
You mean you're going to be his assistant?
That's it. I'm going to try to help Henry to rest and get some relaxation.
That's what I've been praying for.
You too?
Oh, Henry, I'm so relieved. Isn't it wonderful you found someone to help you?
Yes, but...
Where do you come from, Dudley?
Oh, all around.
Yes, but where?
Julia, to tell you the truth, he says that he's an...
I've been doing some social service work downtown.
Oh, and now you're going to be with Henry permanently?
For as long as may be necessary.
Julia, if you don't mind, I must talk to this gentleman alone. I'll see you in a moment.
We were just having dinner. Won't you join us?
That's very kind of you, but I have a number of things to do around town. Oh. You can understand, Henry. So many people making so many mistakes.
Yes, I see.
Then we'll see you tomorrow?
Oh, yes. Bright and early.
Good. Whenever you're ready, Henry. Good night, Dudley.
Good night, Julia.
Are you sure you're an angel?
I know it isn't easy for you, Henry, but you've just got to take me on faith.
Yes, but for how long? How long will it take?
Well, just long enough. Until you can utter another prayer and say that you have no further need of me. Then I'll be gone and forgotten. But now Julia is waiting for you at the dining table. You must go to her.
Right. And so Dudley starts to work to see what's the problem.
And in this ghost story, Cary Grant plays a very different kind of ghost. Of course, he has all of the charm of Cary Grant, but his charm is not just superficial. What this ghost is able to do, and why he's able to touch people so well, is that he sees people. He really pays attention to them. He acknowledges who they are. When he looks you in the eye, you feel that he sees you. You feel that he recognizes you. He does that with everyone he speaks to in the film, and everyone responds, lights up when he talks to them, as if for the first time they've been acknowledged and they feel loved. So he is an absolutely wonderful angel. I'm sorry, I called him a ghost. He's a wonderful angel. He comes in and he works as the assistant to the bishop, played by David Niven. David Niven is a wonderful bishop. However, he's lost his way. He is putting all of his energy into getting the money to build this huge, big cathedral, an edifice to God. He is spending all of his time with these wealthy donors, as opposed to the more simple people that he used to spend time with in the church. He's not spending time with his wife and his little daughter either. And he, in a fit of frustration, he prays to God, asking him to please send someone to help him with all of this. And that's how Cary Grant comes in, to be his assistant and to give him some guidance. But what kind of guidance?
Yes, David Niven thinks eventually that, oh, he's here to help me build the cathedral. But what he's really doing is bringing the ability of self-awareness or self-knowledge.
There's a moment in this, like in the movie It's a Wonderful Life, where he goes through with that dark night of discontent.
Dark night of the soul.
Yeah. And he... and to find out what he really values in his life. Is it being this big bishop who raises money to build a church, or is it a man who looks after his family and looks after the other people he can help? Even though we resolve the kind of Scrooge character in this, it's not really what... There's another point that the movie has to make about refining yourself.
What you said is interesting, because it makes me think that David Niven's character, the bishop, is a little Scroogey himself.
He is, I think. He has lost his way. He has sort of not repudiated, but he's forgotten that everything that's valuable is basically human, and the human spirit and human love and the human heart, which is and he's moving towards this concrete, huge, you know, stone edifice, which is stony and inhuman.
Mm.
Well, one thing is how well this movie gets its themes across and how the characters are so wonderfully portrayed. We've got great cinematography by Greg Toland, and who uses this depth of field. You'll have somebody in the foreground and another character is in the middle ground talking to him, but then they turn and move away, and then they look back as the other person's not looking and gives an expression, and we can see people way in the distance. There's the scene where Cary Grant's talking with the little girl.
Don't cry. Let's do that again.
No. Tell me a story.
What now?
Don't you know any stories?
Oh, certainly. I know hundreds of stories.
Tell me one.
All right, now this happened many, many years ago.
That's not the way to begin. Stories start once upon a time.
Oh, yes, that's true. Well, once upon a time, there was a little boy, and he lived in a little town.
What was his name?
His name was David. He was a shepherd, and the town where he lived was called Bethlehem.
Oh, I know Bethlehem. That's where the star was.
That's right. Oh,
and the other people in the house are kind of drawn in and in the background and listening as they're as this little interchange between the child and Cary Grant is going on.
Well, one night David was out in the hills tending his sheep. He was playing the harp and singing.
What was he singing? Jingle bells?
No. No, jingle bells hadn't been written then. David was singing songs that he wrote himself. Well, suddenly an angel came down and spoke to David.
How did David know it was an angel?
He didn't know. And you know, that's the way it always is. Angels come down and put ideas into people's heads, and then people feel very proud of themselves because they think it was all their own idea. Well, this angel said to David, "One of your lambs has strayed." So David put aside his harp and went out in the darkness to find the lamb. Of course, the angel guided him.
And Greg Toland is superb at photographing Cary Grant's hair. It's just really, he's always very, Toland was always very good with contrasts of dark, extremely inky blacks and brightness. And, you know, Cary Grant's glistening hair looks so fantastic.
Now, who is the director on this?
It's Henry Koster, who, if I may say, is a little bit underrepresented in film criticism. He was a fairly significant director of hits, who's now more or less forgotten, but he was behind such things as Harvey, the movie about the imaginary, I assume, bunny.
And I believe also, it's Lisa's favorite movie.
Yeah, and he directed the first CinemaScope movie, The Robe, for 20th Century Fox, start of the 50s. But he directed movies that resulted in Oscars for at least 6 or 7 performers. His career spanned the history of cinema. And curiously, he resembles Billy Wilder in some ways, both fleeing Europe at the start of the war to evade the Cossacks in the new version of the Cossacks, and ends up in Hollywood not even speaking English like Wilder, but eventually rises to create some of the most interesting commentaries on the American life. And this coincidence underscored by the fact that while making the movie, the producers felt there needed to be a little punching up in the humor. And so Billy Wilder and his writing partner were hired to do a little script doctoring. So Billy Wilder and I can't remember his partner's name, the first one before
Charles Sterrett.
Yeah. Say his name
and
again.
Then Charles Sterrett. And then the original script that they worked on was by Robert Sherwood, mm-hmm. one of the Algonquin crowd, right?
That's true. And it's based on a novel. But Coster was one of those directors. He wasn't flashy. He didn't draw attention to himself. He just wanted the movie to look good, which is why you get Greg Tolan. And he himself wanted to be invisible as a stylist because he didn't want to interfere with the audience seeing and hearing the characters and being involved in the story. That story is a little on the weird side is something I'd like to get into a little bit later. But yes, it's directed by Coster, and it's probably one of 200 or 300 premier examples of the American studio system at its best.
Oh yeah, because they practically had to redo the film, and then they had to recast it, and you know, having the studio system in place, they were able to reset really well. I mean, the final film is a masterpiece in its way.
It is beautiful. It looks beautiful. It's seamless. It's that continuity editing. But what I think also needs to be talked about that's different than today's films is that every single character has a plethora of secondary characters. Oh. All of them were full-fledged characters, fully fleshed out, real people that you feel like you know just as well as the leads, who are played by just wonderful actors, Monty Woolley, Elsa Lanchester, James Gleason. They're just incredible characters that you never forget and that are really important to the film.
Now, Monty Woolley plays this character called the Professor.
My favorite. He is so wonderful.
And we meet him right away. We meet him before we meet the bishop. And it's wonderful, the structure where Cary Grant's on the street watching people celebrate Christmas, and he's helping people that have little problems. And here the audience is clued in to who Cary Grant is. So the audience throughout the whole movie knows more than the characters. And here we have Loretta Young's character, Julia. She's admiring a hat that she likes, but she's troubled. And then she runs into Monty Woolley's character, an old friend. And we learn that she and her husband used to be the bishop in the nearby church, and he was their friend, and they knew everybody. So we get this introduction in this wonderful little exchange right at the start, which helps establish who she is and leads us to what the problem is that the angel is here to solve.
And that's such an important aspect of American cinema from the 30s and 40s, which is to make sure you know who everybody is, what their relations are to each other, and do it in this seamless and seemingly innocuous way. That's not the right word, but you don't know it's happening. You pay attention. You understand what's going on, but you're being informed in this easeful way. And with these incredible character actors who really catch them in your in your imagination, so that you just always know where you are, what's going on. And modern movies perhaps prefer ambiguity, or making you work a little bit harder for your understanding of the movie.
The tensions are present right there, and you become aware of all of the tensions. So Julia is nostalgic for the time that they lived in that neighborhood, and that they knew everyone, and things were simpler, and they were happier. So there's a tension between then and now. There's a tension between the intellectual and the secular and the sacred, between the professor and the bishop. There's the tensions between the mortal and the immortal, with the angel and the professor. There's the tension between the rich and the poor. You've got all of them laid out. It's like this beautiful tapestry of threads that you can just keep pulling. And your interest is entirely held. There's so much going on. Never for a moment, never for a split second, are you the least bit bored by this film.
Now, you mentioned another character actor is Gladys Cooper, who plays the rich woman. And now, Gladys Cooper was a legendary beauty on the British stage in the 1900s, even a mistress of the Bertie, the Prince of Wales, later the King of England. But here we see her later on, but as the film progresses and her, facade is peeled away by the angel, we get a wonderful performance of this great screen actress, Gladys Cooper, all in one take, as we find out the truth behind why she wants this cathedral built in honor of her late husband. She is the sort of initial Scrooge character, but then we realize how much of the Scrooge story is involved with Henry. But first we have this rich woman, lovely portrayed by Alice Cooper, really nice.
Gladys Cooper, not Alice.
Gladys. Oh, Gladys. Oh my God. School's out forever.
I'd like to see the bishop's wife with Alice Cooper anyway.
This woman is part of the frustration that the bishop is having, is that he has to please this woman who has very strict ideas about what kind of how much money she's going to give, and if she gives the money, how much control she's going to have over the cathedral. But Cary Grant, Dudley, says about her early on that we don't know what's in her heart. And that's a big secret that's his secret power. I mean, yes, he's an angel, but I think his real superpower is that he's able to read people's hearts.
In its way, this is a psychological movie.
Absolutely.
Psychology was very big in Hollywood in the for Spellbound and other films like that.
Absolutely, it is. Absolutely, it is.
Now, in terms of the psychology of the characters, one of the things I find fascinating about it is the conflict within Dudley himself. As he's come to Earth, or moved from one part of the Earth to the other to take on another problem, it seems as if he's gradually falling in love with Loretta Young and being tempted to stay on Earth as a human being. And one realizes that one facet of this movie is that underneath all of the supernatural elements and the religious elements, when you get down to the domestic level of the story, it's about a guy trying to steal another man's wife. and she's responding to him really solely because she's been abandoned by her husband due to his various duties and his calling. And he's really tempted by her, and she's tempted by him. And that's where I find the thing a little incoherent, because not in a bad way, but because it introduces levels of complexity that are a little hard to deal with for what you expect the average viewer to want out of a movie. You don't expect it. Go ahead.
No, please go on.
I was literally done.
Well, I think that this just goes to underscore that this film is really investigating human values. Remember, it's 1946. The war is just over. We're just getting all of the news. We're seeing the photographs of the camps. We see some of the photographs of Hiroshima. I mean, we're starting to realize, you know, we've seen the photographs of Dresden. We're just starting to realize how cruel and brutal humanity can be. But yet, in a sense, when it's carried away, swept away by these sorts of passions, and I think the film is an argument to reinstate simple, basic human values of kindness and tolerance, which is what the bishop says at the end. And I think that the angel falling in love with Julia, and Julia does say no. She realizes it at the end, and she says, no, you have to go away. And he says, okay, I'll go away. And I think, you know, they realize, I think that their falling in love is actually a repudiation of the Superman, of the, you know, the supernatural, of mystical powers, and saying, you know, it's really what humans have, this love for each other that we have in our hearts, that is something even the angels envy. And in fact, that's what Dudley says to David Niven. He says at the end, it's, you have made me envy a mortal man. And then, you know, then he leaves.
Oh, that's fascinating. We've got about.
And it's very interesting, the very last shot where Dudley's looking in the church as we hear the sermon, he turns and walks away. And we, Lisa and I were like wondering, do we see his footprints? Is he now, is that the way of visually saying he's now a mortal man? He's now relinquished being an angel, kind of like later in Wim Wenders' great movie, Wings of Desire.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a good connection. Yeah, I'll have to rewatch that and look for the. It could have been inattention on the part of the crew, or, you know, they didn't think anybody else would notice. Although I have to say, those great big sparkly nitrate screens of the day could show you practically anything on the screen. But we have 2.5 minutes left.
Let's just wrap up. So we've been talking about the 1946 movie, The Bishop's Wife, David Niven, who is fantastic in this. There's a great comic, serious performance. Cary Grant, he's entering his more adult phase. He's not doing the crazy loose guy that he did in Arsenic and Old Lace. And Loretta Young still holding on to the glamour and the beauty, and a character that's like, it's totally naive, or just totally wrapped up in your life as a mom and
kind, totally kind.
Yes, totally kind.
But a little puzzled by what's going on around her and not knowing what to do about it. And wanting to protect her kid and make sure that the kid receives attention from both parents instead of just one. And Ilsa Lanchester.
And the great Lottie Woolley.
Yes. We found it very much in the style of Dickens and making a commentary on society, wrapped up in a story, a ghost story, a Christmas ghost story, though in this case, a Christmas angel story.
Anyway, we've been talking to Lisa, all the way from New York State, and Matthew of KBOO's Gremlin Time, and we've been discussing The Bishop's Wife in our special, very special holiday edition of Film at 11.
All the stockings are filled. All that is, except one. And we have even forgotten to hang it up. A stocking for the child born in a manger. It's his birthday we're celebrating. Don't let us ever forget that. Let us ask ourselves what he would wish for most. And then let each put in his share. Loving kindness, warm hearts, and the stretched out hand of tolerance. All the shining gifts that make peace on earth.
Thank you. Hello out there. This is Jello Biafra. If you're tired of the OCA, Walt Disney, Westinghouse, General Electric, and police departments telling you what you should listen to, stay tuned in to KBOO Portland, listener-sponsored, non-commercial community.